Welcome to Launchpad, a Tech Glass podcast which reveals what is needed to scale a successful technology startup. In each episode, industry players such as entrepreneurs and investors will discuss one aspect of growing a technology company and offer practical advice for scaling your business. Scaling companies have dual marketing objectives in growing brand awareness while generating demand for their products or services, often in a challenging environment. Today, we're joined by three marketing leaders at fast-growing UK tech companies to discuss their approach to both brand awareness and demand generation, their relative importance at different stages of the buyer journey, how companies can stand out and remain relevant in the market, and strategies for overcoming the challenge of a difficult economic environment. Welcome to Gavin Peters, who's VP of Marketing at modular cloud insurance platform Genesis, Helen Mayall, who's the CMO at View, a tech platform for out-of-home advertising born within advertising giant JCDecaux, and Charlie Gilbert, VP Marketing Communications at real-time payments network Vault. Hello to everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
We also have our co-host for this episode, who's Nick Taylor, MD of Taito. Taito is a European PR and communications agency at the intersection of technology, science, and innovation. Right, let's get into it. Helen, first of all, View operates in the digital out-of-home advertising industry, which connects programmatic buyers and sellers via a marketplace, doesn't it? Obviously, like I said before, you are born between JCDecaux. Is that right, Decaux?
Yes, so we're 93% owned by JCDecaux. That was our origin. So we work with both JCDecaux media owners around the world, as well as other media owners not within the JCDecaux family.
Absolutely. We're going to come on to that in a little while to sort of explain the importance of that as you're trying to change an industry. But first of all, how do you define brand awareness and demand generation? And how do you kind of balance those aspects?
Sure. So we're very B2B focused. You know, we don't expect the person on the street to have heard of us, but certainly within the out-of-home industry, that's one of our core markets. But we actually are also very focused on a parallel industry, which is the wider digital media. And it's all about driving demand for programmatic, which is essentially changing the way that out-of-home is bought and sold. It's much more aligned with the way that the rest of the digital media industry is traded. And so for us, it's not just about growing awareness of View, but very much growing demand for this way of trading. So growing the overall pie. And that's really critical because we want to ensure that we're, you know, yes, growing the number of the amount of out-of-home inventory that we can sell, so partnering with more and more media owners, but also driving demand from the buy side, so from advertising agencies and the brands directly, about using programmatic and using out-of-home in a programmatic way.
Charlie, I'm going to come on to you now. So Vault is building a global real-time payment network, and to do that, you're using account-to-account payments. What comes first, growing brand awareness or driving demand? Or do you find that they work in tandem?
They absolutely work in tandem. I think the danger of almost kind of positioning the question that way, I suppose, is alluding to them being mutually exclusive, which is certainly not the case. And I think it speaks a lot as to the marketing's function and dual function in terms of brand awareness and then driving demand, as kind of complementary or complementing disciplines. I think also the other thing that's probably worth flagging is that brand awareness, certainly in terms of my understanding, is a term that's bandied around quite loosely. We all know what it means, but also it's slightly ambiguous as well. So we're kind of conscious of that at Vault. We talk a lot about brand credibility and how we do that on top of brand awareness. And then what is really important to us is brand recall. So what brand is it that somebody thinks about when someone mentions open banking, for example, in terms of the space that we occupy, real-time payments or account-to-account payments? We want Vault to be the brand that kind of jumps out there. To achieve that, can be done via various channels in terms of advertising, website, campaigns, etc. But that's underpinned by super relevant messaging, right, according to our ICPs, but also valuable messaging for kind of the wider ecosystem. I suppose open banking is quite a zeitgeisty term, so we want to be part of that conversation and be seen and actually act on, I guess, kind of the innovation aspect as well. So Yeah, that's kind of my take on that. They're kind of complementing disciplines that should serve each other rather than kind of exist as separate pillars.
So Gavin, just to introduce your company first, Genesis is a modular cloud-based solution for the insurance industry. Before we get on to you know, how you approach, you know, marketing as budgets are squeezed, you said to me the other day that you don't think all marketing is measurable, do you? Especially when it comes to brand awareness and this kind of recall marketing that Charlie's talking about.
Yeah, so yeah, just to clear out what Genesis is, first of all, because I know that's quite a complicated way of describing what we do for the insurance industry, but ultimately we provide software to the insurance industry. So we provide your end-to-end administration software. So if you're an insurance business, you need to handle your policies, your admin, your claims, your billing. We manage all of that, provide a software platform to run an insurance business from. So like the core platform to run an insurance business. In terms of, yeah, when I said it's not all measurable, my point there is, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, in B2B, when you're dealing with a relatively small enterprise sales market, it's not the same as going out and measuring B2C. I've done a lot of B2C work. You can do surveys, you can collect a lot of data, you can get a real deep dive into how many people are aware of your messaging or your products. With B2B, it's a lot more difficult. It's probably doable, but I think in terms of what you're really striving to achieve, your best way forward is to try and just understand your customers in the best way and make sure messaging is getting out there in the right way as much as possible. And don't try and get sort of dragged into a kind of analysis paralysis. So massive believer in data. We do use data to inform all of our decisions. But I think the danger is in a B2B market, you can try and get into the bottom of every sort of number that's possibly available and trying to find out whether CMOs, CTOs, COOs are aware of your product in a market like that is very, very difficult. So the, you know, it's where you put your efforts and your energies, and we try and make sure we find that balance. So it's, you know, doing the right things to the right market. And a lot of the time we'll use awareness, we'll use a proxy of kind of reach to understand awareness.
Yeah, it's like if you spend all your time just measuring, staring at dashboards, then you know, you're not working on the business. And especially when you're scaling a business, you really need to sort of action things and move quickly. And I know people do have kind of data scientists and they have people that are there to kind of analyze, but you know, especially when you're a smaller team and you're all kind of like pitching in together, you know, you kind of have to take what you can learn, action it, move on to the next thing, and then find those points where you come back and analyze it again, right? Just to talk a bit more about Genesis. So you're selling to insurers, managing general agents and brokers.
Yep.
Now, if the number of people that are involved in the buyer journey is already quite high, isn't it? And obviously you're selling to a few different people and budgets are being squeezed. How do you get through that? How do you sort of like reduce the complexity of that to actually just get, you know, buying decisions made?
Yes, that's been a learning journey for me. So I've been in insurance coming up to 2 years now. So my background is marketing and tech marketing. So I moved into the insurance industry and people said it was a slow moving industry. Or it takes a long time to get a sale done is probably the more fair representation. So it's a long buying cycle. Hadn't quite realized quite how long that is until I got into there. And, you know, it does take a long time when you're doing enterprise sales and insurance. It's highly regulated. You've got a lot of data to manage. You've got a lot of existing platforms to if you're selling in new software, to migrate off of. So it does take a long time. And yeah, there are more people getting more involved, I think, than ever before. So for us, it's really just to make sure, first of all, you've got a really clear strategy of understanding the main buyers, so the main decision makers in that process, and the entry, the people who are going to start the process off. So you're engaging with the right people. So we absolutely prioritize the core personas. For us, that would be your CTOs, for example. Your CIOs would be one of the first that might look at your business to upgrade their software. But we've also got underwriters, operators, financial people, marketers. But then throughout the process, just making sure you're engaging with the whole team constantly. So through your digital or direct comms to the market, but really face-to-face as well. We really try and make sure that our marketing, our sales teams are absolutely aligned on bringing people through that journey. So for a B2B market like we're in right now, that's quite tight and it's quite tightly defined, it's maximum communication. And I think it's utilizing everything that we can. It's from digital marketing to phoning people up, having as many meetings as possible, always listening to our audience. And I just learned so much just by talking to them all the time. So you've just got to kind of work hard to make sure everyone in that company is brought along this journey and they understand why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, and as you're kind of moving through that sales funnel, Helen, I suppose just having visibility on what's happening is key, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we use a CRM system. It was implemented, just after I joined. And that's really important because it enables us to look at, what the value of campaigns are that are being booked on our platform, which markets they're coming from. Are there repeat bookers who we want to help try and grow the value of their campaigns through us? And we can also see where are those opportunities of brands that are advertising in one country where we can actually use that to open the door and have the conversation in another of our entities around the world. So it's really helpful for us to be able to see that. And that's mostly what the sales team are and the commercial team are responsible for doing. In terms of the marketing team, we absolutely also use, the same CRM system, which also then powers our website, our back end, in terms of understanding who our contacts are, but also seeing when they visit our website, have we, initially made contact with them at an event? Because we do still have that mix of, that offline presence as well as doing, online metrics. So, have we first of all engaged with them at an event that marketing has pushed for? Whether it's a speaking opportunity, and then are they visiting our website? Are they downloading any of our content, any of our thought leadership? Are they engaging with us on our social platforms? And for us, that's primarily LinkedIn, because we are a B2B business. And so we can see through the funnel, at all of the touch points that they're engaging with us in. And then when they come to the point of actually booking a campaign, we've got much more visibility on which of our marketing metrics are actually working. That does take time, of course, but it just means that we're continually refining. But it is really useful for us. Not everything, I think I'd agree with Gavin, not everything is 100% measurable and tangible. But it, as much as possible, it gives those guidance of, what is the ROI? Because, we're equally in a challenged environment where, the marketing budget that I ask for is never the one that I get given. So as much as possible, I am, showing the value of what marketing is bringing and that we are supporting those revenue goals and we are supporting those targets that we're achieving.
So you mentioned before how, despite being founded within, a large advertising company, you're also connecting some of their kind of competitors on your platform, yeah, on the supply side. What are the challenges there with trying to convince them that, the data is not going to be used for like the parent company, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that we've evolved in terms of where we were born out of, which was the world's largest out-of-home advertising company, and then very much this key strategy of growing our relationships with other media owners. And we've taken steps like we have a PwC audit that looks at our systems to make sure that the sensitive data isn't being accessed by people that shouldn't be accessed. We also have a client portal which has product information on it, and that is password protected. So there are measures in place that ensure that there is ring fenced areas of information that the competitor cannot access, and that's very important for our buy side, our sell side platforms, the media owners, to give that reassurance that they can work with us. And the reason they want to work with us is because we can bring so much demand to them, because of the relationships that we have, an exclusive opportunity for buyers to book with JCDecaux inventory. So, by aligning and being alongside that, it's actually very attractive. But yes, we do take, big steps to make sure that we are able to provide that reassurance. And that very much aligns with our value of, transparency and trust. And we want to ensure that we're really, truly able to stand behind that.
There's been a bit of a shift, according to research, when we're talking about sort of broader demand generation. So rather than looking at the sort of traditional way of doing things, you're looking more towards like account-based marketing, for example. So like you've got your sales team and your marketing working closely together to convert sort of leads into sales. So again, this is, you're talking about the visibility in the funnel, but everyone on that CRM system being connected. Can someone explain to me, Charlie, if you would you just tell me a little bit more, a little bit about how that kind of approach works for you?
Yeah, sure. So I think kind of Gavin touched on a really good point earlier, which is the long lead times you can quite often get in financial services and insurance. And I think a good example for us at Vol is kind of what that process looks like to us when we are selling to an enterprise merchant, for example. And this is where account-based marketing really kind of comes in. There are various kind of value propositions that need to be articulated. Vault is very fortunate in terms of the fact that we offer open banking payments, which offer essentially instant settlements compared to card payments, which take 3 to 5 days. And those settlements come at much lower costs compared to cards. So we're not a difficult sell, if I'm honest, which is really good. However,
it's like a startup business, isn't it? If it's quite easy, the elevator pitch is, you know, I get it straight away. You say, yeah, I'd like to invest in that business. With you guys, exactly. You're selling a product and they're saying, yeah, I get it. You're saving me money. You know, you're doing it instantly, selling it instantly.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm on board.
Exactly that. I think the reality and how the world works with enterprise merchants, where there are global teams and payment processes and kind of integration considerations, that kind of lead time takes slightly longer. And then comes the actual integration itself and a testing phase. So this can take kind of weeks and months. But this is where I guess kind of the ABM motion comes in. So kind of pre-sale. So kind of talking about those kind of core value propositions and very much tailored to the account that we're going after and knowing how to reach the key contacts there. But then it continues post integration as well. This is actually a really interesting point about where B2B comes B2B to C. Because we then essentially come in as the marketeers and we speak to that enterprise merchant's marketing team, and their opening gambit is quite often, okay, we've integrated Vol, it's been with our payments team and our tech team, now it's come with us. And the first question I often get is, why would our users use Vol? Why would they choose pay by bank at checkout? So then it becomes a kind of supplementary marketing exercise or even a kind of marketing pitch. We are selling Vault through the eyes of our marketing team to the merchant's marketing team. So there's a lot of handholding, and it even kind of calls into play like the traditional extent of an ABM motion and what it actually involves. But I guess kind of the fact that these considerations all have to be entertained and discussed by experts in their field, that the end result of that is actually quite powerful. And when you see a kind of enterprise, kind of global company integrate our solution at scale across different markets with different currencies and different languages, and we kind of are at the forefront of that as marketeers in terms of optimizing what that looks like. And that's when marketing also descends into descends might be a bit too negative, but product marketing, so kind of application at checkout, color schemes, turn of phrase, positioning, it's kind of part of the whole process. And yeah, that really kind of end-to-end ABM motion, I suppose.
Gavin's nodding along there. Like you said to me, Gavin, if you're trying to grow your kind of brand presence, but then someone goes to the website and there's no use cases on there, you know, there's no sort of story about what the company actually does and how it does it, then it's all kind of just throwing money away, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was going to go back. I'll be keen on getting the feedback from Charlie and the guys as well on the attribution on that. So when you've got a long sales process, you may do a load of activities on that account-based marketing journey. So for us, it might be we met them at an event 2 years ago, and then they came back to the website, then downloaded a white paper, the sales team's been out and made a few calls to them, and it's just over a number of different activities you've ended up building up this relationship. And then the finance team always want to know what's the ROI on each of those independent things, and you sort of go, well, it's quite hard really, because we've done so many different things, and it's actually just a multiple of all these things. So I have that constant kind of conversation about your back to the analysis that you were talking about and data, and probably limitations of it in some senses, that building those attribution models, probably need someone a lot smarter than me to do that, but in terms of understanding what each touch point does, I think it's a kind of constant trying to understand which touch points are doing which bits to try and give you that kind of ROI number. But I'm keen to see how everyone sort of approaches that, because it's a, or do you just kind of just go, well, it's just a, we just know loads of things work and we analyze them as a whole. So I'm doing your job, Jonathan, and asking other questions. But I will
I was
come
say,
back.
Who wants to come in? We set the scene, but I think we need to have a conversation about this. Yeah. Who wants to come in?
Sorry, Helen, you go.
Charlie, okay, thank you. I think from our perspective at Vue, we're definitely tracking, certain specific pieces of content. So of course we can look at how many people have opened a case study or downloaded. Every year we have one very large piece of research, and we put some campaign spend behind that, when we release it, both from a PR perspective, and then we follow up with sponsored socials. And from that, we're able to look at how many people have downloaded, because it's behind a form fill. So we're gathering information because we know that it's going to attract also new potential customers. And then we're able to go through and see through our CRM system, actually how many people then ultimately booked a campaign through our platform. So we do have a measure of influenced revenue, it's called. And over and above that, we're also measuring things like the number of social media followers, because for us, thought leadership is very much aligned to this original goal that I mentioned around growing the overall pie. This is a new way of buying out of home media that's only been around for, less than a decade. And whilst this technology has worked in other media channels and they're now at the sort of 90 plus adoption levels, it's still, in the sort of single to low double digits in some of the markets, and some countries haven't even got to that point yet. So we're very much looking at, can we grow this overall pie? So for us, thought leadership is a really big thing. And we measure that through, how many people are following us, because if we can communicate, we can keep that narrative going. Yes, you might not make a sale in the next 3, 4, 5 months, but we know that in time, as people become more confident, more knowledgeable about the way that programmatic works for out of home, then they do convert, because we've seen that trajectory and adoption rate in other parallel digital media, 10, 15 years ago. And so we fully expect that that's going to come to us, and we're starting to see the evidence that supports that as well.
Yeah, I know we've interviewed Jean-Christophe Conti, your CEO, on Business Cloud for our, sister website to TechBlast. But actually, I guess you're targeting the kind of advertising media more than anything else, because the people that the people that are following you on social media,
yeah,
the people in that industry. So that's kind of your kind of core,
yes,
demographic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Media agencies, brands. That's our bread and butter.
What about everybody else? Do you kind of, do you target your marketing into certain media industries, or do you kind of just try and raise brand awareness overall?
I've just got a quick point to make on the attribution point. If that's okay, Jonathan, if we can revisit that quickly. I don't know if it'd be interesting or not, but it might be worth flagging. I think to kind of Helen's point, we kind of measure marketing touch points in our CRM as well. I guess there's almost that kind of cultural point then within a scale up, in that kind of access to data is one thing. It's more kind of what the kind of various commercial strategy and marketing teams do with that data. And often in a scale up, there isn't enough time to analyze it in a lot of detail. And then I think what the knock-on effect of that is that the marketing and sales teams almost become a kind of de facto growth team. They're kind of joined together and kind of working in harmony, where we all share the same goals. And that probably feeds into, the levels at which the marketing team supports the sales team with kind of key messaging. Also the fact that I'm kind of often involved in pitches with merchants and kind of like helping to articulate perhaps kind of some complex things that need translating that, say, a salesperson might miss. So we're kind of almost existing as this larger kind of growth team, I think, in this kind of fast-growing scale-up environment. And I think attribution is therefore kind of almost shared and almost kind of celebrated as a collective. I don't know if that chimes with anyone else, but that's certainly at this kind of like pre kind of mega corporate stage of the business how it seems to be at the moment.
Totally agree with that, and I was exactly like that as well. In this size of business, when you're scaling, the sales and marketing team becoming a kind of joint growth team. But the point for me on the attribution, really more than anything, is it's very easy to make a mistake of assuming the first touch point is the thing that drove the end sale, and therefore that's where you should put your money. And that's where a finance team can, well, not a finance team, but anyone looking at the business, you can look at the ROI, you can look at it and assume that, okay, that one thing we did, let's attribute everything else that went on to that first initial touch point. Obviously, it was vital, but you need to understand all the touch points across that journey and understand the nuances of all the relationships that are being built in an enterprise sale like that that might take a couple of years. And that it takes a bit of work, but it's really crucial to try and understand how all of those different parts are playing a role, from how the salesperson makes the call to the white paper they've downloaded to when they first met you at the event. But it gets increasingly difficult on a longer term sale when you're doing account-based marketing to try and attribute anything to one initial touch point. But it sounds great because you can go, oh, we went to that event, and off the back of that event, we got 15 sales. But actually, the crucial thing might have been something halfway through that journey where you did something else with them and they already a piece of content or they did something else. So it's quite complicated on a longer term sale like that. But I think people need to respect that it is and use a little bit of their own analysis and logic behind it as well to get to the right answer.
So sometimes you need to kind of take that anecdotal evidence from yes. conversations with real people rather than just kind of like you say, Gavin, yeah, going to a CTO and saying, can you fill out this survey? Tell us where you heard about us first. And actually, the key thing is trying to feed that anecdotal evidence back into the system. Absolutely. So people are aware of it and you can make it work for you.
Yes.
But Nick, I want to bring you in now. So we talked about Taito being, you know, European PR and communications agency, and got this focus on technology and innovation. Recently spoke to your senior partner and head of integrated, Sean Gaskell. She contributed to our MarTech Insights report, and she found that marketers are operating in a challenging economic conditions with consumers and businesses now more discerning about how they spend their money. So I think the key point there is there's a need to do more with less as marketing budgets are squeezed. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And do you know what? It's actually been great to hear sort of the our sort of three panelists talk about how actually joined up you all are and how I think, you know, this sort of doing more with less point, there's the sort of nuance with it, I think, goes beyond just the kind of like economic environment that we're all operating in. It goes towards this idea of, you know, we want to shift towards a much more integrated approach when it comes to marketing communications more generally. So this idea of more with less is, when we have assets, sort of creative ideas, how do we make sure we're really sweating these assets? How are we getting the maximum value that we possibly can from every single thing that we're doing? I think, Gavin, as you said, like, how do we actually making sure that whatever sort of a prospect or a customer is seeing, how is that fed right back into the funnel again? And actually, but I think this sort of drive for efficiency is having a really beneficial effect on the kind of marketing more generally, because it's actually bringing a lot of disciplines closer together. Because you have the finance director looking at these sort of big reports, big sort of data, big research, whatever it is that sort of different parts of marketing might be doing, and saying, hey, how are we making sure that actually this is being used to the absolute sort of maximum value? And this is something that we're seeing a huge amount of. And, you know, whenever it's really simple things, right? So it's like when a client of ours is getting some great coverage in a national publication, great. Okay, so that coverage has gone live. That's great to see. Now, what do we do with it? So, you know, in historically, where the silos exist within clients, it might be, okay, so that coverage has gone live, great, to get out in social, and then it sort of disappears into the ether. I think what we're seeing increasingly is, okay, something's happened. How do we then plug that into an ABM machine? How do we then actually use that? How do we then give that to our sales team so that they're out there in the field using that, say, that piece of coverage that's gone live? How do we actually make sure that when sales teams are going to events, they're able to actually then go and speak to prospects about this. So how does this, all of these great assets actually be used across all of these different disciplines? And I think that is this point around doing more with less. And actually, so this sort of challenging environment that we find ourselves in where budgets are constrained are kind of forcing marketing to actually be much more efficient with the assets and the creative that they're creating. And we're really excited about that because this is ultimately really beneficial. I think good things happen, you know, there's always sort of benefits of being in difficult times. I think that's one of the big ones for marketing as a whole.
Yeah, you talked to me about that, Gavin, didn't you? Talking about if you've got an asset and it does well, you write a blog about it, maybe you do a, you know, a podcast about it or a YouTube video, a one pager to the sales team, but, you know, sweating those assets to a certain point anyway is quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's balanced as well, because I think you've got to think about where the where you need to make those efficiencies and sweat each asset. And I said to you, I think that, I think sometimes there's a real need for it. You're, as we just talked about, you'll do a podcast or something, and then you can write a blog, a white paper, some social content off the back of it and all those things. But there are other times where actually you do want some more ideas and you do need to do a variety of activities, because I don't, you know, in some businesses, certain like ours, it's not always not a lack of ideas. It's actually a lack of time to implement them. It's just there's so, like with us, we've got a lot of different personas we need to talk to. We need to talk to the, like I say, the COO, the CTO, the underwriter, everyone involved in that process. We'll need slightly different content. There's different markets we talk to. We're international. We'll talk to different businesses within those markets. So you've just got to find the balance. Yes, you could do a great piece of content that's focused on for us, focused on an underwriter in an MGA. And we go, fantastic. Okay, that's great. So let's just sweat that for the next few weeks. And you go, well, actually, we've not really then talked to our other personas as well. So you've really got to find that balance of making sure that you're doing, it needs a lot more thought, I guess, a lot more clarity on your strategy. You're going to choose some very, very strategic main pieces of content, and then you're going to sweat those. What you don't want to do probably is just, you know, jump onto a few things, and because they're good, just keep repeating that, because then it's not strategic. You're probably missing a core part of your objectives. So yes, it does mean that you are maximizing efficiency, but you've got to be really disciplined in doing that, so that you are choosing the right pieces of content to sweat, and it's not tail wagging dog. Well, this one was good, so let's just keep doing more of that, and you haven't thought it through as to what's the objective of that in the first place, and is it reaching?
What's your approach then, Helen, in terms of, you know, maximizing that impact and you know, sweating assets and actually just making sure that you're efficient in your marketing?
Yeah, sure. So we definitely try and use things as hard as we can. To your point, Gavin, that, you know, when you don't have the largest team and you don't have unending budget, I think you do need to make things work as hard as possible. It's very interesting for us because we essentially talk to two or three different audiences. You know, we have digital buyers who know programmatic but don't know the nuances of out of home. And that's where we're trying to drive incremental revenue for. We're then also talking to people who have traditionally always bought out of home, but in a very direct IO insertion order way. And this is a new way of, you know, with new capabilities and new flexibilities. They need education as well. And then we also have the sellers, the inventory owners, the media owners, and they need to get comfortable with this new technology that's going to change their future, we think. It certainly has done in other industries, and it's going to change the way that they're selling. But, you know, they can't switch overnight, right? You know, so there is definitely a journey that you take people on. So there we have a lot of assets that, you know, might be 2 or 3 years old, but we're still using them because there's always people coming in who need education, whether that's because it's new technology to that country. And literally, you know, as you go into new markets, you can use something that we might have used in the UK 3, 4, 5 years ago because it's a more mature market. But also, I think there are still people in the UK who are, you know, much earlier in their journey because they're just starting to understand and just starting to test and learn, you know, what the best way of using programmatic in out of home is. So I think that the assets that we have, we've sort of created definitely some more 101 type, you know, entry level assets, that whether that's on video or, you know, a one pager or blog, whatever it may be, but then that we also have the more advanced, you know, as people get comfortable, what's the best way of utilizing this technology for your campaigns to make them more relevant, more flexible, more appropriate to the audience, you know, trigger based on, you know, whatever bit of data that you want to utilize. And so there's a wide range of what we do, but as I, you know, this is why having assets that you can, you know, in some ways track and see, okay, are people still using that or does it need a refresh, you know? So that's one thing that we'll look at. But, you know, I mentioned earlier that we look at social media followers, and that's, we definitely have targets around that. We can look down to then, you know, which countries are they coming from? And that helps to, again, to focus, you know, what is the type of asset that we might want to promote in this market because it's fairly early in its journey. But then also, you know, what's the coverage that we've achieved from a specific piece of PR, or how many people are actually inquiring with us? Because we also do have just an open, you know, form fill on our website. Again, you know, hello@view.com, you can just write us an email and we'll also measure that pipeline. And that's something that we is utilized both by media owners who decide they want to start working with us, but also the buyers as well, who are looking to understand how to get into programmatic out of home. So they might go to our YouTube channel, they might go to our website, they might send us an email, but all of these our measures of looking at, you know, the impact that we're having. And, you know, we know that brand awareness can be one of the hardest things to measure, but I do take the fact that people are proactively coming to us as a metric of our brand visibility, and, you know, they're hearing about us. So whilst we don't spend a lot of money on outbound marketing in the sort of, you know, going out and generating leads, but actually if we're having these inbound inquiries, that's again a measure of all of the other assets that we're going out with in terms of trying to educate and grow the market are paying dividends.
It's also a sign that you're doing something right and you've got a product that people want to engage with, right?
Yeah, Nick, it's always you know, when you say, okay, well, we've got a bit of a backlog. But yeah.
Someone please get back to these leads, please. Nick, I'm doing a lot of the talking here, but you're the expert, really. So you work with some really big companies in Europe and elsewhere, and you know, we're talking different countries here, companies that have raised like Series D funding, maybe even more than that. How do you kind of construct a campaign, you know, and how do you kind of balance this, you know, demand generation and brand awareness?
Yeah, and I think this sort of link between awareness and then to demand is something that we're seeing more and more for clients. And again, it's something that we're really excited about, this sort of this slightly more enlightened way of looking at awareness more generally and how that bridges over to their demand engines. Breaking, like I said, is to us, it's all about kind of breaking down those silos, and ultimately what that means is it sort of starts from an idea, and we like this sort of concept of editorial first. And when we're thinking about ideas and that creative for our clients, editorial first is a really important driving force. And that's, does it work for editorial, does it work for the media? If the media is going to be interested in this concept, in this idea, then we feel like it has legs, then it will have some traction. Once it has traction, okay, then how can that actually then be used for different audiences as well? How can it be used for customers, for prospects, even for employees as well? And, you know, you look at all of the different sort of audiences that communications are hitting from a business, making sure that that idea is editorial first is a really important way of then getting that sort of idea out there into the world. I think actually, Helen, just something that sort of picks up on from sort of reading things about Vue is that you've grown massively in terms of headcount. Do you feel like that? How has communications had an impact on that? How has marketing had an impact on that? Has that sort of actual sort of employer branding been a key part of the way in which you've created your strategy? And or is that sort of happened organically as you've grown?
I think it's very definitely a deliberate aspect of what we do in marketing. You know, there's someone in my team who part of her role is actually to support and work with our people team to attract, retain and develop talent, because we do find that particularly in our industry, we were looking for people who have an advertising technology background. And so the best way to recruit is actually referrals. You know, our people team have an incentive, an employee incentive for referrals. But we also love the fact that a lot of our employees are very organically, you know, sharing our content, or they're advocating, you know, they're spontaneously posting on LinkedIn or wherever, so that their network is then seeing, you know, a lot about what they're doing and why they like to work at Vue. And we have also done some recordings with our employees, you know, understanding, you know, what is it that keeps you at Vue. We invest a lot in that employee brand, employer brand, and, you know, the things that we see around that are valued by our teams around hybrid working, flexibility, gender neutral parenting policy, you know, a learning development fund. We have diversity initiatives and inclusion initiatives. You know, we have a global customer base. It's really important that our team reflects that. So for us, that means multiple nationalities, different locations, supporting people, you know, whether they have caring responsibilities or parental responsibilities, whatever it may be, because when we have happy employees, they're very very spontaneously, as I said before, you know, advocating why they love working at Vue. And, you know, we have great ratings, which we're not complacent about at all. We work really hard at this. but it's a deliberate strategy to ensure that we're recognizing talent, we're recognizing and rewarding people. And it's not necessarily a monetary reward, right? People value, if you notice them or if you have a shout out. So we have company values, that we have a Slack channel. You can call someone out and just thank your coworker and thank your colleague. And that goes so far. You know, it's not always top down. It's very much organically within the company. We do also have, you know, more formal recognition, of course, but all of these things combined are really what helps us to grow and retain and attract talent. So yeah, we've grown massively from sort of, you know, 20 to I think now 180, and we're still recruiting. And you know, we're pleased that people are now, with a company that's 6 years old, we have a few people who are coming up to their fifth, sixth anniversaries with us, because they've grown with us, and we definitely want to keep and retain that talent.
That's great. I mean, I think one of my favorite sort of feedback from clients when we've done sort of really creative campaign, one of the great pieces of feedback is, oh, you know, we've seen this explosion in applicants to this role, because they've seen this sort of go live and they've got excited about it. And or it's that, you know, we've had this big sort of chatter in the business around it and people are really excited about it. And I love that kind of like that sort of positive externality of a really, really sort of creative marketing campaign. Charlie, you're like, Vault is a very, very, your value proposition is, like you say, it's great to explain, and people must get really excited about it when you explain it. How do you think about creativity? What's your sort of creative process with sort of coming up with campaigns and ideas?
It's always a bit of a balance, right, between a few different things. So I guess, like, I like to nominate myself as the creative person, but it's also kind of we're a founder-led business, and his vision normally kind of has to translate into any campaign or has to be consistent with that. Not that it should necessarily lead in terms of sentiment, but it should kind of form part of that. And then it's really kind of tangibility. So we're kind of anchored or wedded to our value proposition, which is universal, but has nuances across different verticals and different markets. And then I think once you've got kind of those two things, it's about getting under the skin of your ICP and putting yourself in their shoes, and then exercising a bit of creative license there. So we work very closely with our design team, and I guess our whole business model is about being disruptive in the payment space. So that has to translate to the deliverables that they create. On my side, on the kind of more kind of written comms and content design, to an extent, we have a style guide and tone of voice guidelines, and that informs the kind of level of messaging that we initiate, and also how far we can push things. There are quite a few things at play here in terms of that style guide has buy-in and approval from our C-suite. So we know what parameters we're working in. And occasionally it's a case of like, oh, I'm not sure we can say that in the Brazilian market because of X, Y, and Z. That's quite often a subjective take. We can then go back to the style guide and say, look, we've created these guidelines, so we can say this here. We think it's worth testing. There's always that business case there. I think it's kind of, yeah, entertaining all of those variables, but being confident in our kind of individual expertise, and also where we're heading as a brand. The brand positioning point is massive in every campaign we initiate. So therefore, kind of what our competitors are doing by contrast, and how we can play to our strengths versus their strengths, or indeed weaknesses, is also really key to any kind of campaigns that we create.
What about you, Gavin? So what are the challenges and opportunities that you face, you know, when it comes to you know, awareness and demand generation?
So we're in quite a competitive marketplace, and I think the challenge, I think, is a lot of people trying to say the same kind of thing, even though you probably do things slightly differently. And when it's quite a complicated business, your differentiators can get a little bit lost. So we've taken a bit of a step back from, we obviously do push the product, and we do push how, you know, proud we are of the product, all the things that it can do for the business. We have to push the use cases out. We have to really talk about what it does for businesses and you know, the money you can save and the time you can save through great software. The difficulty is, whether it's true or not, there's a lot of copycat messaging, and people will say the same things. So probably slightly different from Charlie's industry, where that sounds like you're a bit more, if not unique, you're one of the key players in that space, where there's not a lot of people that can provide the same arguments, at least for the software, for the product that you have. Whereas in policy administration software, there's a lot of people that would claim to do the same thing in terms of they provide a solution that they'll say they'll save you money and they will manage in the best way. So we have to pull out a few key features. The problem is how much appetite the customer when they first come and engage with you, is how much they want to really get into that sort of deep dive versus just have a conversation. So we very much then lead on the brand positioning, personality wise, in terms of the team that we've got, the kind of end results you'll get, the solution that we provide overall, the kind of business that you're engaging with. And then we save more of the deep dive stuff for the demos and going into the real product differentiators in there, because to really get into the nuance of the product, the product, you have to sort of get under the hood of it and really see what that does. And it's just a bit difficult to get that across when you've got probably limited attention span on that first touch point. So for us, the brand engagement piece is key. It's just differentiating us as the kind of the people that you want to work with as the team. You can trust us. You can believe in what we say because of the proof points. And then that sort of like tees it all up underneath that. Then you can start getting into product messaging. And I say probably a literal example of that would be, say, how we handle like our social media. We put quite a lot of effort into the kind of scheduling of what we do. So, for example, we'll put a big brand post out. It will be very much based around the people, or it might be, you know, the kind of content, you know, that is going to get a lot of engagement with the industry, very friendly, very human-based stuff. Once we know we've got that kind of peak content, we'll follow up with the product messaging underneath. So the next post after that will be very much, you know, a product or a customer sort of use case, because then we're sort of getting into the kind of engagement. We're growing the engagement and following up with that messaging at the key time. So for us, it is absolutely fine in that balance of showing the kind of business that we are and getting the product messaging in it just the right way.
Yeah, you really do want to tell that story. I mean, Helen touched upon it as well. You know, it's not just about what your product is and what it does. You know, you want to attract people to your business, you want to retain people within it, and actually attract customers as well. You need to tell that story, whether it's the, you know, the people and the culture. Although when I interviewed Jean-Christophe, the CEO of Vue, he said that they recruit on values, not culture fit. He said, if you recruit on culture fit, you just end up recruiting the same profile.
Yeah.
Whereas if you recruit on values, then you get a diverse group of people in, but people who are all kind of like pulling in the same direction, if you like. It's been, I think we're running out of time, so we need to get onto that, you know, to wrap up the pod with, you know, your quick fire tips. I could talk about this for hours. But first of all, I want to come to Helen. Just give me sort of two, three, or even one, just quick fire tips for effective marketing within a scale up business.
I would say agility, learn fast, and get creative. Gavin made the point, differentiation, when you can't compete on, you know, with the biggest budget, doing something different, and maybe there's a bit of personality in there. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a strong brand personality. That was very much a definite tactic that we use. That differentiation shows that you've got something to talk about that's quite interesting, and people might just want to give you the time of day to investigate a bit more.
What about you, Charlie? What's your quick fire tip?
So biggest tip by far, I might have two, but we'll see if we've got time for both of them. The first one is understand the CEO or the C-suite's elevator pitch, I suppose, their vision for the company. Get under the skin of that and understand that that is what is driving this scale up forward. And then as a marketer, translate that into a tangible value proposition for prospects and customers. Don't fall into the trap of relying on essentially that kind of ultimate company vision as being that kind of North Star direction for marketing comms, because it just won't work. It can be useful context, it can be useful guidance, but it's not the one thing that should drive the creation of a value proposition and then the articulation of that value proposition across different markets and verticals. Have I got time for a second tip, a quick one?
Always.
is in a scale-up environment, embed yourself into every other team and understand what they're doing and understand how you can add value as a comms professional or a marketing professional to their activities, whether that's account management, sales, strategy, people and culture. As comms people and as guardians of the brand and the brand messaging, there is value to be had there, and it certainly helps with kind of all pulling together in the same direction. So I would strongly advocate for that team collaboration, or pestering other teams.
Gavin, is Charlie nicked any of your tips there?
All of them are going to say exactly the same. So I was trying to think of something different. So no, I'm joking, but I 100% agree with what Charlie and Helen said. I would probably, just to add to it, to put some more on that, I would say always be authentic and don't forget you're talking to human beings. If you're doing B2B or B2C, but particularly B2B, that you're selling to people first of all. So don't hide your personality.
What about B2B2C, which is what Charlie's been talking about?
Even more important, you know, because you've got to show you understand their audience. But then the second thing is, goes back to Helen's point earlier about reusing content. It triggered a thought with me, which I was thinking is, don't get scared of kind of going back to good ideas and repeating them, because you can really assume that everyone's bored of an idea way before you are. When you're in a company that, you know, if you're in a massive B2C company, you get all the research that says, yeah, carry on. Nike keeps saying, just do it. That works. Whereas when you don't have that data, it's quite easy to think, well, we've done that. We should move on now and try something new. Yes, you should always be agile and try new ideas. But if you've got something that works, don't get bored too quickly with that. Really explore it and keep pushing it, because there's a lot of noise out there. So to cut through, you've got to repeat things a lot of times. I think that's a really key point that a lot that I see sort of forget that. Always trying to start again, and you lose traction that way.
The strap line is quite important, isn't it? So Tech Blast, Launchpad for Growth. Now, if you just said Tech Blast, you'd say, what's that? But Launchpad for Growth, oh, you start to get into the nuance of startup businesses, you know, you then go beyond that. But yeah, it's quite important. Nick, we've talked a little bit before about, you know, the kind of way that you would approach marketing for some of these, you know, scaling companies that you work with. What are you going to take away from the discussion today? Is there anything you want to add on the tip side?
There's a couple of things I thought were really interesting. One is this idea of like anecdotal data or anecdotal feedback, right? So sitting there and just being guided entirely by the numbers is a really, and if we had more time, it'd be great to just actually dive into that. Because I think there's almost this idea of trusting your gut, trusting your expertise, and trusting the gut and the expertise of the people within your team, of your sales teams, of your marketing teams, and knowing that they know when things are working, when things are resonating, and a way of actually plugging that into the way in which you actually talk about the ROI of different campaigns is a really interesting sort of concept and idea. And I think we all do it on a day-to-day basis, but actually sort of hearing it spoken about in that way is really fascinating, because it's tempting to just say, oh, we just solely follow the data. So I think that'd be a really interesting sort of thread to pull on. I think the other thing, just as a really, really general point, is just this, and everyone has spoken about this at times, is this idea of bringing everything together almost under one roof. So I think, you know, Charlie, you were talking about embedding within teams and getting under the skin of your sort of sales teams, of your different sort of execs within the company, and how important it is to kind of understand and absorb all that knowledge. And then more generally, making sure that actually everything that you're doing is being brought together, that everything is joined up, that any kind of assets or whatever, or campaigns or creatives that you're doing is working throughout the whole of the business is such an important point. So I think lots of good stuff to take away.
I think that sums it up nicely, really. I don't think I could add anything to that. It's been an absolute pleasure, you know, speaking to everyone today. So thank you ever so much. If you've got any feedback on today's episode, or you'd like to share your thoughts on scale-up marketing, contact us on LinkedIn or X, comment on the video episode of this podcast, or drop us an email at podcasts@businesscloud.co.uk. If you enjoyed the episode and found it useful, please like and subscribe on your preferred platform. So it could be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, or others. And you'll be among the first to hear insights from renowned entrepreneurs and investors. Thanks for listening, and see you soon. Launchpad is a Tech Blast podcast produced in partnership with pan-European B2B tech PR and communications agency Taito. New episodes are streamed on Tech Blast's YouTube, LinkedIn and Twitter pages from 12 p.m. on the final Friday of every month. Or you can find all episodes on YouTube and all major audio podcast platforms. Subscribe now so you never miss an episode.